Adams was concerned that Franklin, out of laziness, was leaving too many decisions to Chaumont or Bancroft. But if Adams was disillusioned by the Franklin he came to know at Passy, he also recognized that Franklin had the confidence of Vergennes and the French court, as did no other American. And it was therefore the duty of all to treat him with respect. In all that he wrote in correspondence in his first 9 months in France, Adams never criticized Franklin. And inclined as he may have been at times to side with Arthur Lee, he steadfastly refused to do so. Lee may have been justified in some of his anger at Franklin, Adams felt, but Lee was badly cast in his role, a dreadful aggravation to Franklin and also to the French, who not only disliked him but distrusted him, which was more serious. As time passed, Adams's appreciation of the importance of France to America's future only increased. "The longer I live in Europe and the more I consider our affairs," he wrote, "the more important our alliance with France appears to me." Yet he felt he himself was in an impossible role. He saw the futility and unnecessary expense of having three commissioners, and after 6 weeks in Paris, as early as May 21st, he was writing to Samuel Adams to say that one commissioner, Franklin, would be quite enough. As it was, he and Arthur Lee were superfluous. One of the rare occasions when the three American commissioners did anything together was the day of Adams's presentation to Louis XVI, on May 8, 1778. Accompanied by both Franklin and Lee, Adams arrived at Versailles in all new French clothes, his wig dressed, and wearing a dress sword, as required at the palace. They were received in the king's sumptuous gilded bedchamber, as the king went through the elaborate morning ceremony of being dressed by officers of the state. In a brief, pleasant, inconsequential exchange, the Comte de Vergennes explained that the new American commissioner spoke no French, to which the young monarch responded, "Pas un mot," not a word, before passing into another room. Adams detected goodness and innocence in the king's face. "He had the appearance of a strong constitution," Adams would write of the 24-year-old Louis XVI, who was indeed kind-hearted and robust, if painfully nearsighted and awkward, and who had it in his power to determine the fate of the United States of America. In June, at the public supper of the royal family, Le Grand Couvert, Adams was turned out again in attire becoming the station I held, but not to be compared with the gold and diamonds and embroidery about me. Seated in close view, among ladies of the first rank and fashion, he felt himself being gazed at in the way he and others had once gazed at the Indian chiefs who came to address Congress, except that he found it difficult to command such power of the face as the chiefs had. The king, the royal carver at the table, ate like a king and made a royal supper of solid beef and other things in proportion. But in the account Adams gave years afterward, it was the graceful Marie Antoinette, a gleam in diamonds and finery, who remained most vivid in memory. "She was an object too sublime and beautiful for my dull pen to describe. Her dress was everything art and wealth could make it. One of the maids of honor told me she had diamonds upon her person to the value of 18 million livres, and I always thought Her Majesty much beholden to her dress. She had a fine complexion, indicating her perfect health, and was a handsome woman in her face and figure. The queen took a large spoonful of soup and displayed her fine person and graceful manner in alternately looking at the company in various parts of the hall and ordering several kinds of seasoning to be brought to her, by which she fitted her supper to her taste. When this was accomplished, Her Majesty exhibited to the admiring spectators the magnificent spectacle of a great queen swallowing her royal supper in a single spoonful all at once. This was all performed like perfect clockwork. Not a feature of her face, nor a motion of any part of her person, especially her arm and her hand, could be criticized as out of order. That June 1778, Great Britain attacked French ships at sea. The war for American independence had set off a struggle for power in Europe. Britain and France were again at each other's throats. There was no declaration of war, nor would there be one. Yet, Adams would rightly inform Samuel Adams, there is in fact as complete a war as ever existed, and it will continue. With little to do of a diplomatic nature, he took hold of administrative duties, striving to straighten out accounts and expedite correspondence, no less determined than he had been on board the Boston to see a badly run ship put in order. His long experience on the Board of War stood him in good stead. He drafted reports to Congress, set off letters to various agents of Congress in France who had been drawing exorbitant bills on the commission, directing them to start providing regular account of their disbursements, and warning that they could be running up debts beyond available funds. He addressed the matter of prizes taken at sea by American privateers, and gave all possible attention to the vexing issue of what to do about American prisoners of war held by the British, and those British prisoners taken on the high seas who were being held in France. The commissioners hoped for an exchange, but were frustrated by British insistence that captive Americans were traitors, and thus not conventional prisoners of war. "I found that the business of our commission would never be done unless I did it," Adams wrote. "My two colleagues would agree on nothing, and often when I had drawn the papers and had them fairly copied for signature, and Mr. Lee and I had signed them, I was frequently obliged to wait several days before I could procure the signature of Dr. Franklin on them." If Franklin was slow to get underway in the morning, Arthur Lee found it impossible to arrive from Chaillot, only 10 minutes away, earlier than 11 o'clock, by which time Adams, who rose at 5, had been at his desk for hours. Privately, he was distraught and painfully lonely. It had been more than 3 months since he had left home, and still there was no word from Abigail. He worried about her, longed for her, and in this felt still further removed from Lee, who had never married, and Franklin, whose wife was dead, and who, when she was alive, had spent years apart from her with no apparent regret. Franklin amused himself playing chess with his fashionable friends, including Madame Brion while she bathed in her tub. Adams did not know chess. Franklin had his Masonic meetings. Adams was not a Mason. As at Philadelphia after his first weeks there, he began to tire of lavish hospitality, the profusion of unmeaning wealth and magnificence. Such incessant dinners and dissipations were not the objects of his mission to France. "My countrymen were suffering in America, and their affairs were in great confusion in Europe." "Dined at home," became a frequent note in his diary. Through June there were few entries at all, so concerned had he become about a house full of spies. When a first letter from Abigail arrived on June 16th, he wrote to her at once. But it would be midsummer before he heard from her again, and numerous letters that he wrote in the intervening time were either stolen, lost, or captured at sea. He would never know. Nor would it be known how many of her letters disappeared en route. As once he had sent Abigail pins from Philadelphia, so now, at her request, he shipped off packages of European trade goods, handkerchiefs, ribbon, bolts of calico, which could fetch hard money at home and mean the difference to her financial survival. But as with all correspondence, months must pass before he knew if any of the shipments were reaching her. There was no news from Congress, no news of the war at home, which was as formidable a problem as any. Dispatches from Philadelphia that evaded capture at sea took at least 6 weeks to reach Paris under ideal sailing conditions. The great distance separating America from Europe, the inevitable long delay in any communication with Congress, or worse, the complete lack of communication for months at a stretch, would plague both Franklin and Adams their whole time in Europe, and put them at a decided disadvantage in dealing with European ministers, who maintained far closer, more efficient contact. Ships that were supposed to sail for America in a week or two often lay in port for months, letters on board. By contrast, there was no European court to which an express could not be sent from Paris in 10 or 15 days, and an answer could be expected within approximately the same time. There is, I imagine, no minister who would not think it safer to act by orders than from his own discretion, wrote Franklin in a letter explaining why he and the other Americans in Paris had to decide matters on their own most all of the time. To receive an answer from an inquiry to Philadelphia could take 6 months. Relations between Franklin and Lee grew steadily more unpleasant, and Adams's role consequently became ever more frustrating, to the point where he felt he must unburden himself again to Samuel Adams, providing what was in all a very fair assessment. "Between you and me, I have a difficult task," Adams wrote on August 7th. "I am between two gentlemen of opposite tempers. The one may be too easy and good-natured upon some occasions, the other too rigid and severe upon some occasions. The one may perhaps overlook an instance of roguery from inadvertence and too much confidence. The other may mistake an instance of integrity for its opposite. Yet both may be, and I believe are, honest men and devoted friends to their country. But this is an ugly situation for me, who does not abound in philosophy and who cannot and will not trim. The consequence of it may very probably be that I may have the entire confidence of neither. Yet I have hitherto lived in friendship with both." With the passing of summer, Adams grew extremely disheartened. His one unfailing source of pleasure, the joy of my heart, was John Quincy, who, he told Abigail proudly, was esteemed by all. A prominent figure in Franklin's circle, Marie Grand, wife of Ferdinand Grand, the French banker for American funds, was so impressed by the boy, indeed by both father and son, that she wrote Abigail to tell her so. In a conversation with Adams at a dinner, she recounted, he had remarked that in some cases it was the duty of a good citizen to sacrifice his all for the good of the country. She had found such a sentiment worthy of a Roman, yet rather hard to believe. Surely nature, love of one's wife and children, would operate more powerfully than love of one's country. In reply, Adams said his wife felt as he did. "And young John Quincy, too," Madame Grand told Abigail, "inherits the spirit of his father and bids fair to be a Roman like him." Adams had never had more to do in his life, he wrote, or so little to show for his efforts. Maintaining a position of impartiality between Franklin and Arthur Lee, playing mediator, had become a dreadful strain. In October, determined to improve the situation, Adams urged Lee to give up living at Chaillot and move in with them at the Hôtel de Valentinois. "I am very sincere," he wrote. "There is room enough in this house to accommodate us all." He offered Lee his own quarters, saying he would move into the library. "This arrangement will save a large sum of money to the public and give us 1,000 opportunities of conversing together, which now we have not. it would remove the reproach we now lie under, of which I confess myself very much ashamed, of not being able to agree together. I am, dear sir, with an earnest desire and a settled determination to cultivate a harmony, nay, more a friendship, with both my colleagues." When Lee declined, strife within the commission grew worse. "The uncandor, the prejudices, the rage among several persons here make me sick as death," Adams wrote in his diary. His two compatriots were men of honor and integrity, he still believed, but the one grew increasingly cunning and dissipated, the other sour, secretive, and no less cunning. "Virtue is not always amiable," Adams concluded. Feeling his role was little better than that of a clerk, feeling forgotten by Congress, he labored on intensely, writing letters, struggling with accounts, trying to keep abreast of events through the London newspapers and magazines, where he now saw himself derided as pathetically out of place. "The English have got at me," he reported to Abigail. "They make fine work of me. Fanatic, bigot, perfect cipher, not one word of the language, awkward figure, uncouth dress, no character, cunning, hard-headed attorney. But the falsest of it all is that I am disgusted with the Parisians." He hated playing second fiddle to Franklin. And by the year's end, to judge by a letter written to James Warren, Franklin's self-indulgent, self-serving ways had become nearly more than Adams could bear. For though he mentioned no name, it was obvious whom he meant. "The longer I live and the more I see of public men, the more I wish to be a private one. Modesty is a virtue that can never thrive in public. Modest merit? Is there such a thing remaining in public life? It is now become a maxim with some, who are even men of merit, that the world esteems a man in proportion as he esteems himself. I am often astonished at the boldness with which persons make their pretensions. A man must be his own trumpeter. He must write or dictate paragraphs of praise in the newspapers. He must dress, have a retinue and equipage. He must ostentatiously publish to the world his own writings with his name. He must get his picture drawn, his statue made, and must hire all the artists in his turn to set about works to spread his name, make the mob stare and gape, and perpetuate his fame." Yet the mood that poured from Adams's pen did not always match the spirit with which he went about his daily business. And the gloom or vitriol of one letter might be nowhere apparent in others written at the same time, even the same day. He wrote little or nothing, for example, of how he and Franklin worked together. Yet live and work together they did in close proximity for months on end while accomplishing much. Once, several years earlier, in one of the many passages in his diary in which he worked out his thoughts, Adams had written that concealment of one's dislike for another was not a form of dishonesty or deception, but an acceptable, even wise way of conducting the business of life. "There are persons whom in my heart I despise, others I abhor. Yet I am not obliged to inform the one of my contempt, nor the other of my detestation. This kind of dissimulation is a necessary branch of wisdom, and so far from being immoral, that it is a duty and a virtue." But this, he was quick to add, was a rule with definite limitations. "For there are times when the cause of religion, of government, of liberty, the interests of the present age of posterity, render it a necessary duty to make known his sentiments and intentions boldly and publicly." Whatever Franklin's failings and flaws, Adams never discounted the value of his popularity and prestige. French esteem for the good doctor remained of immense importance to the American cause, as Adams knew. Arthur Lee, by contrast, was seldom anything but a handicap. His dislike of the French was obvious. His countenance is disgusting, Adams was to write. His air is not pleasing, his temper is harsh, sour. His judgment of men and things is often wrong. What most distressed Adams about Franklin was his approach with Vergennes. He hates to offend and seldom gives any opinion till obliged, Adams noted. It was what had troubled Adams about Franklin in Congress. Although he has as determined a soul as any man, yet it is his constant policy never to say yes or no decidedly, but when he cannot avoid it. Franklin's concept of diplomacy was to ask for nothing that Vergennes would not give, be grateful for whatever help the French provided, and remain ever accommodating and patient. As Franklin's friend Condorcet would remark approvingly, Franklin, as a diplomat, observed much and acted little. Adams, no less than Franklin, felt the French alliance must be cultivated with perfect faith and tenderness. But he was apprehensive of too much diffidence. He worried about the effect in the long run, as he explained to Roger Sherman in a letter he appears never to have sent. There is a danger that the American people and their representatives in Congress may have too much timidity in their conduct towards this power, and that your ministers here may have too much diffidence of themselves and too much complacence for the court. Specifically, he warned of excessive attention to what the French thought, what France wanted, and too much French influence in our deliberations. In 1776, Adams had argued in Congress that any alliance with France must be commercial only. To James Warren, he had expressed his shame at the whining he heard that all was lost unless France stepped in. Are we to be beholden to France for our liberties? But now, with the end of the struggle no nearer in view, and with his newfound regard for the French, Adams saw things differently. France was a rock upon which we may safely build, he told Warren. Like George Washington, Adams saw that sea power could decide the outcome of the war. Specifically, he saw French naval support as the crucial necessity, and felt duty-bound not just to voice his opinion to Vergennes, but to press for a greater commitment of French naval power, even at the risk of annoying the proud foreign minister. Earlier in the summer, a French naval expedition under Admiral Charles-Henri Théodat d'Estaing combined with an American land assault against the British at Newport, Rhode Island, had failed, news that didn't reach Paris until late in the year. Thus, to Adams, it was clear that more French ships were needed and no time was to be lost. Franklin agreed, but counseled moderation. In December, Adams drafted a letter to Vergennes, which Franklin toned down. It was their most important undertaking together. Signed by all three commissioners and submitted in the first week of January 1779, the letter stated that nothing would bring the war to a speedy conclusion more effectively than sending a powerful fleet sufficient to secure naval superiority in American waters. Such a naval force, acting in concert with the armies of the United States, would in all probability take and destroy the whole British power in that part of the world. Vergennes, however, chose to ignore the letter. His thoughts for the time being, and as probably the commissioners did not know, were taken up with the prospect of a French invasion of England. On September 14, 1778, at Philadelphia, Congress named Benjamin Franklin Minister Plenipotentiary to the court of Louis XVI. The three-man American commission was dispensed with. It was midwinter, however, before word reached Paris. The official dispatches did not arrive until February 12, 1779. The new arrangement was exactly what Adams had recommended, and the news was to leave him feeling more miserable than ever. He had been ill for the first time since coming to France, suffering from a violent cold and trying to cure himself in characteristic fashion by walking 10 miles a day. Though he had clearly indicated that Franklin should be the one chosen, there had always been the possibility that Congress might pick him. Arthur Lee was dispatched to Madrid. But Congress had neglected to provide any instruction for what he, Adams, was to do, neither recalling him nor assigning him to a new post, which was both mystifying and insulting. Adams was not even mentioned in the communique. Such being the case, he made the decision on his own, informing Vergennes that as he had been restored to the character of a private citizen, he would depart. He submitted a request for passage on the next available ship bound for America, and to Congress addressed a long letter saying that since no notice appeared to have been taken of him, he could only assume that Congress has no further service for me on this side of the water, and that all my duties are on the other. I shall therefore soon present before you your own good man. Happy, happy indeed shall I be, he announced to Abigail, trying to see the bright side. To Richard Henry Lee, he claimed his new status as a private citizen, best becomes me and is most agreeable to me. In truth, he was hurt and angry, and justifiably. He had been badly served by a Congress that told him nothing and showed no gratitude for all he had done. He felt himself strangely adrift, less able than ever in his life to sense what lay in store for him. In a letter to James Warren, he vowed never again to allow himself to be made the sport of wise men or fools. His moods swung from high to low, then lower still with the arrival of a packet of letters from Abigail, filled with abject loneliness and accusing him of neglecting her. "All things look gloomy and melancholy around me," she wrote. "You could not have suffered more upon your voyage than I have felt cut off from all communication with you." Adams claimed to have written nearly 50 letters to her between April and September, which was almost certainly an exaggeration. But whatever the number, she had received only 2. "Let me entreat you to write me more letters at a time. Surely you cannot want subjects." What he wrote, she said, was always too brief, cold, and impersonal. It was as if he had changed hearts with some frozen Laplander. Trying to respond as calmly as possible, Adams wrote and burned 3 letters in succession. One was too sad, the next too angry, a third too cheerful to reflect the truth, as he explained in a 4th and final version. "Was it possible that some infernal has whispered in your ear insinuations? Had she forgotten the unalterable tenderness of my heart?" he asked. "For God's sake, never reproach me again with not writing or with writing scripts. Your wounds are too deep. You know not, you feel not, the dangers that surround me, nor those that may be brought upon our country. Millions would not tempt me to write you as I used to. I have no security that every letter I write will not be broken open and copied and transmitted to Congress and the English newspapers. They would find no treason or deceit in them, it is true, but they would find weakness and indiscretion, which they would make as ill use of." In another letter, written after receiving 3 from him, Abigail said she had no doubt of his affection. "But my soul is wounded at a separation from you, and my fortitude is all dissolved in frailty and weakness." She could not understand his reluctance to express his love. "The affection I feel for my friend is of the tenderest kind, matured by years, sanctified by choice, and approved by heaven. Angels can witness its purity. What care I, then, for the ridicule of Britain, should this testimony of it fall into their hands? Adams enlisted support from John Quincy, who told his mother that Papa could write but very little because he had so many other things to think of, but he cannot let slip one opportunity without writing a few lines, and when you receive them, you complain as bad or worse than if he had not wrote at all, and it really hurts him to receive such letters. "If I were to tell you all the tenderness of my heart," Adams confided, "I should do nothing but write to you. I beg you not to be uneasy." As the time to leave drew nearer, he grew increasingly woeful. What had he accomplished, after all? Did anyone care? "I am left kicking and sprawling in the mire. It is hardly a state of disgrace that I am in, but rather of total neglect and contempt." What was to become of him? He had never been in such a situation. "My present feelings are new to me." Not since the most anguished diary entries of his youth had he declared himself so overburdened with woe. "If ever I had any wit, it is all evaporated. If ever I had any imagination, it is all quenched. I believe I am grown more austere, severe, rigid, and miserable than I ever was." As ardently as he longed for home, he hated to leave Paris, hated to leave France, and expected he would never return. "The climate is more favorable to my constitution than ours," he acknowledged to Abigail. He loved the food, the civility of everyday life. "The French were the happiest people in the world, and have the best disposition to make others so. There is such a choice of elegant entertainments in the theatric way, of good company and excellent books, that nothing would be wanting to me in this country but my family and peace to my country, to make me one of the happiest of men." The one tribute he received was a letter from Versailles, a letter Adams treasured. Vergennes, speaking for the king, offered praise for "the wise conduct that you have held to throughout the tenure of your commission, as well as the zeal with which you have constantly furthered the cause of your nation while strengthening the alliance that ties it to His Majesty." What appears to have pleased Adams no less was the discovery during his parting call at Versailles that his French had so improved he could manage an extended conversation and speak as rapidly as he pleased. The two Adamses took their leave of Benjamin Franklin and others at Passy on March 8, 1779, and with the servant Stevens departed by post-chaise for the coast of Brittany. At the bustling port of Nantes on the lower Loire, they settled into a hotel to wait for passage on the American frigate Alliance. Days passed, eventually weeks, during which father and son were together steadily. Biding their time, they walked about the town and along the river. Through long afternoons, Adams helped the boy in translating Cicero. In late April, they moved on board the Alliance, only to learn later still, in a letter from Franklin, that orders had been changed and the ship was not to sail for America after all. However, a French frigate, La Sensible, was due to sail from L'Orient with a new French minister to the United States, Chevalier Anne César de la Luzerne. Franklin gave instructions that the Alliance carry Adams to L'Orient, but on arrival, Adams found that Minister La Luzerne had been delayed. And so the wait went on, father and son remaining on board the Alliance. In the days that followed, Adams spent considerable time with the daring young Scottish-American naval officer John Paul Jones, who was fitting out an old French merchantman that he had renamed the Bonhomme Richard. They had met earlier at Passy, corresponded over naval matters, And Jones, quite unjustly, had decided that Adams, in his role as commissioner, was conspiring against him. Privately, Jones referred to Adams as a wicked and conceited upstart, and expressed the wish that Mr. Roundface were at home minding his own business. Having no part to play, no say in anything, no useful work, and no choice but to wait, was more nearly than Adams could bear. He began brooding. Imagining himself the victim of more than mere chance, he saw Jones and the old conjurer Franklin at the bottom of his troubles. He was being kept waiting, being humiliated intentionally. "I may be mistaken in these conjectures. They may be injurious to Jones and Franklin, and therefore I shall not talk about them, but I am determined to put down my thoughts and see which turns out," Adams wrote in his diary. "Do I see that people despise me, or do I see that they dread me? Can I bear contempt to know that I am despised? It is my duty to bear everything that I cannot help." From time spent with Jones, Adams decided he was the most ambitious and intriguing officer in the American Navy. Eccentricities and irregularities are to be expected from him. They are in his character. They are visible in his eyes. His voice is soft and small. His eye has keenness and wildness and softness in it. Adams never doubted that faces carried clues to character. The white-as-paper pallor of Condorcet bespoke dedication to hard study. The eyes of Voltaire, with their fine frenzy rolling, were the eyes of a poet. In the face of Louis XVI, Adams had seen goodness and innocence as clearly as he saw keenness and wildness and softness in the eyes of young Jones. But then, studying his own face in the mirror, Adams did not like what he saw. There was nothing exceptional about him, he concluded, writing in his diary, "By my physical constitution I am but an ordinary man. The times alone have destined me to fame." There was too much weakness and languor in his nature. "When I look in the glass, my eye, my forehead, my brow, my cheeks, my lips all betray this relaxation." Yet he could be roused, he knew. Yet some great events, some cutting expressions, some mean scandals, hypocrisies, have at times thrown this assemblage of sloth, sleep, and littleness into a rage a little like a lion. Most days, however, passed pleasantly enough. It was by his own choice that he dined often with Jones, spent hours in conversation with him and his officers, and, as always, Adams was buoyed by talk. He and the surgeon of the Bonhomme Richard, an especially companionable man named Burke, discussed everything from mathematics to rheumatism, Paris, London, the war at home, the war at sea, medicine at sea, the absence of profanity on French ships, and the nuances of the French language. At a dinner hosted by Jones at L'Epée Royale in town, the talk turned to two ways most recommended for learning French: to take a mistress and to attend the Comédie Française. When in good humor, Dr. Burke asked Adams which he preferred. Adams responded in like spirit, "Perhaps both would teach it soonest, to be sure sooner than either." But in his diary, he felt obliged to add, "The language is nowhere better spoken than at the Comédie." "On board all day, reading Don Quixote," was the single entry for May 18th. It was June by the time the French minister, La Luzerne, arrived at Lorient. On June 17th, Adams and John Quincy went aboard the Sensible, and that afternoon they were finally under way from France, Adams having no idea how very soon he would be returning. Section 4. There was no advance word of the arrival of the Saint-Cybe. The latest information Abigail had received at the end of June in a letter written the first week of April was that Adams was waiting to sail on the Alliance. But then in mid-July, Mercy Warren had passed along information received through James Lovell to the effect that Congress had in mind a new appointment for Adams, and that nobody seems to have an expectation of his return at present. In the year and a half of her husband's absence, Abigail's distress had been worse than she had ever anticipated, or she was certain than anyone could ever realize. Known only to my own heart is the sacrifice I have made and the conflict it has cost me, she had confided to her sister Elizabeth in the first weeks of his absence. I wish a thousand times I had gone with him, she later told John Thaxter. For the first time in 14 years of marriage, she had had to face an entire winter on her own. How lonely are my days, how solitary are my nights, she had written to Adams in a letter that would not reach Passy until after he had departed. Her sister, Mary Cranch, of whom Abigail was extremely fond, continued to reside nearby in Braintree with her husband and family. But Sister Elizabeth had married and moved away to Haverhill near the New Hampshire border. Unimpressed by Elizabeth's choice in a husband, the young Reverend John Shaw, Abigail had tried to dissuade her, but without success. Men are very scarce, to be sure, Abigail had written by way of explanation to her own John. And now Nabby, too, had gone off for an extended stay with the Warrens, leaving Abigail feeling more solitary than ever. Earlier in the fall, when the French fleet put in at Boston, she had had her own encounter with French hospitality. A delegation of French officers, resplendent in royal blue and scarlet uniforms, had appeared in Braintree to pay their respects to the wife of the American commissioner. She was invited to dine on board one of their ships, which she did twice, delighting in the perfect manners of the officers and the sense of being at the center of things. On another occasion, accompanied by Colonel Quincy, she dined with Admiral D'Estaing on board his magnificent flagship, Languedoc, possibly the finest warship in the world. "If I ever had any national prejudices against the French, they are done away," she wrote, "and I am ashamed to own I was ever possessed of so narrow a spirit." But in winter, surrounded by mountains of snow, secluded from all society, she could as well have been in Greenland, she said. In other times of separation, times of horrible duress with war at her doorstep and epidemic disease raging, she had somehow borne up, with so much to contend with, so little time to dwell on her own loneliness. "This is a painful situation," she wrote to James Lovell, "and my patience is nearly exhausted." But there was a further complicating element, and that was Lovell himself. When Adams had wondered from the tone of her letters if some infernal might be whispering insinuations in her ear, he was not far from the truth. In the first weeks after Adams's departure for France, Abigail had confided her state of mind to Lovell, who in response had written that her alarms and distress only afforded him delight. More letters followed, in which Lovell addressed her as Portia, presuming to use Adams's pet name for her, and inquiring whether he must limit himself to language devoid of sentiment. She replied, saying, "I begin to look upon you as a very dangerous man, a most ingenious and agreeable flatterer." Yet she signed her letter, Portia. Writing again, he appealed to her with a line from the Scottish poet Alan Ramsay, declaring if ye were mine, how dearly I would love thee, and underscored the word love. When, at the start of a new year, she wrote to say Adams had been absent for a full 11 months, The reply from Lovell was closer to the raw double entendres of Lawrence Stern's Tristram Shandy, a book Abigail had never read. He expressed relief that her husband's rigid patriotism, again underscored, had not left her pregnant again. Telling her not to imagine Adams doing anything in his private hours in Paris other than attending museums, Lovell, by insinuation, raised the question of what else Adams might be doing. Lovell was a married man who, in 5 years of Congress, never once returned to Boston to see his wife and children. That he enjoyed the company of several women in Philadelphia was no secret there, but whether Abigail knew of this is not clear. In Lovell's defense, it could be said that other men, too, would, as time went on, find Abigail Adams an irresistible correspondent. Young John Thaxter, as an example, and most notably Thomas Jefferson. Her spirit and intelligence, her interest in their lives, her fund of opinions, seemed to elicit confidences such as they shared with few others, though none in the salacious manner of Lovell. Abigail could have called a halt to the exchange with Lovell at any time had she wished, but she did not. Clearly, she enjoyed his flirtatious attention, but primarily she craved information, intelligence, and more than anyone in Congress, Lovell had shown himself willing and able to keep her supplied with news. He reported to her on the war, sent copies of the weekly Journals of Congress. As the most active member of the Committee for Foreign Affairs, he was also in the best possible position to keep her posted on anything pertaining to her husband. At no time was she indiscreet in what she wrote, and if he was, she refused to be intimidated. She needed him. That her affections rested entirely with her dearest friend, and that she longed only for his return, she left no doubt. "I love everyone who manifests a regard or shows an attachment to my absent friend," she told Lovell. And however infrequently she heard from her absent friend, she kept writing to him at length, with never a let-up. On August 2nd, 1779, a clear summer day with the blue waters of Boston sparkling in sunshine, the two Adamses and their servant were rowed from the Sensible to a point on the Braintree shore not far from where, under such different conditions, their adventures had begun. With no one expecting them, the shore was empty. Their arrival at home was a total surprise. Try as he would through life, John Adams was never able to express adequately his attachment to home, his adoration of his wife and children. And the effect of his long absences since the onset of the war had only intensified these feelings. "I am, with an ardor that words have not power to express, yours," he had closed a letter to Abigail. And though her wish that he be less stringent in his expressions of affection was entirely understandable, there was never a question about the depth of his feelings or his devotion to her. But at last, there was no need for either to write anything. They were together again, and their happiness, the happiness of the entire family, could not have been greater. The farm would have been at its summer peak, and one may imagine John and Abigail walking their fields together, John glad for home ground beneath his feet again, and delighting in the look of things under her management. There would be hard cider again to start the day, fresh vegetables from the kitchen garden. There were relatives and old friends to see, his mother, the Cranches, Colonel Quincy, Parson Wyberd. Neighbors stopped to bid him welcome. Together he and Abigail rode over Penn's Hill to visit with her father at the Weymouth Parsonage. But mainly, it appears, Adams kept close to home, within familiar walls and the embrace of his family. The three children who had remained with their mother had all grown and changed. all had stories to tell him, and hung on his own telling of his travels, the sights he had seen. The talk went on day and night, and doubtless John Quincy demonstrated his French to the amazement of all. Time and again, when away, Adams would profess preference for the simple domestic life by Penn's Hill above anything he knew. Time and again, on reaching home, he would say that there and there only was everything he desired. It was a lifelong refrain, and his enjoyment now seemed to bear him out. Sweet though it was, the interval was no time out of time. The war weighed too heavily on everyone's mind. The scarcities, inflation, taxes, and profiteering, the incessant worries and enmities of war were all ever present. Adams experienced firsthand the amazing depreciation of the currency, of prices so high as to be laughable under any other circumstances. Abigail and friends spoke bitterly of a selfish, avaricious spirit that had taken hold to a degree unthinkable earlier. A highly indignant James Warren told how fellows who would have cleaned my shoes 5 years ago had amassed fortunes and are riding in chariots. The news of the war was not encouraging. In the spring of 1778, Washington's army had emerged from the ordeal of winter at Valley Forge a stronger, more disciplined force. That June, when the British chose to evacuate Philadelphia and march back to New York, Washington had hit them at Monmouth, New Jersey, in a major battle which, though indecisive, had proven that his so-called rabble were well able to hold their own against the vaunted enemy. But then both armies were back where they had been before, with the British holding New York, the Americans outside keeping watch, and in the aftermath of the failed French and American effort at Newport that summer, the war appeared at a stalemate. Attention shifted to naval engagements between the French and British in the West Indies and to British forays into the South, where in the spring of 1779 the Americans were defeated at Briar Creek, Georgia. There were British raids along the coast of Connecticut that summer, shortly before Adams returned, and apprehension along coastal Massachusetts that a major British strike there might be in the offing. But no one knew, and nothing seemed to portend a resolution of the struggle. Adams had been home hardly a week when the town of Braintree chose him as a delegate to the State Constitutional Convention. Adams accepted and immediately began preparing himself. There being as yet no national constitution, the form of government chosen by each of the states was a matter of utmost gravity. The constitution of an independent sovereign state had to stand on its own merits, not serve merely as a secondary component of a larger, overarching structure. On September 1st, Adams was off to Cambridge, to the first church at the corner of Harvard Yard, where some 250 delegates gathered. In another few days, he was chosen as one of a drafting committee of 30, who met in Boston on September 13th, and in turn picked a subcommittee of three, Adams, Samuel Adams, and James Bowdoin, who was president of the convention, whereupon the other two picked Adams to draw up the state's constitution. He had become, as he later said, a sub-subcommittee of one. The work was to be his alone. And if ever he had a chance to rise to an occasion for which he was ideally suited, this was it. So many of his salient strengths, the acute legal mind, his command of the English language, his devotion to the ideals of the good society, so much that he knew of government, so much that he had read and written, could now be brought to bear on one noble task. Nor could circumstances have been much more in his favor. He was rested, refreshed, inspired by the welcome home and by the honor his town and fellow delegates had bestowed on him. He could work at home in familiar surroundings, his books and papers about him, and with Abigail's steadying presence, which was always to his advantage. That his efforts were for his own Massachusetts was also of very great importance. After the frustrations and disappointments of France, such a chance to shine again must have seemed a godsend. Possibly, had there been no difficult time in France, no feelings of failure, his performance now would have been something less. In any event, the result was to be one of the most admirable, long-lasting achievements of John Adams's life. To prepare, he had reviewed in detail those constitutions already framed by other states and reread his own Thoughts on Government. He worked through the still warm days of late September in his office just off the front hall. He worked at a plain, tall desk at which he wrote standing up or perched on a high stool, and he appeared to have completed the draft sometime in early October. Printed copies for the consideration of the convention were ready at the end of the month, on or about October 30th, 1779, his 44th birthday. It was titled, A Constitution or Form of Government for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Adams having chosen to use the word Commonwealth rather than state, as had Virginia, a decision he made on his own and that no one was to question. A tone of absolute clarity and elevated thought was established in the opening lines, in a preamble, a new feature in constitutions, affirming the old ideal of the common good founded on a social compact. The end of the institution, maintenance, and administration of government is to secure the existence of the body politic, to protect it, and to furnish the individuals who compose it with the power of enjoying, in safety and tranquility, their natural rights and the blessings of life. And whenever these great objects are not obtained, the people have a right to alter the government, and to take measures necessary for their safety, happiness, and prosperity. The body politic is formed by a voluntary association of individuals. It is a social compact, by which the whole people covenants with each citizen, and each citizen with the whole people, that all shall be governed by certain laws for the common good. A Declaration of Rights, following the preamble and preceding the Constitution itself, stated unequivocally that all men were born equally free and independent, words Adams had taken from the Virginia Declaration of Rights as written by George Mason, and that they had certain natural, essential, and unalienable rights. It guaranteed free elections, and in one of a number of articles borrowed from the Constitution of Pennsylvania, guaranteed freedom of speaking and liberty of the press. It provided against unreasonable searches and seizures and trial by jury. While it did not guarantee freedom of religion, it affirmed the duty of all people to worship the Supreme Being, the great Creator and Preserver of the universe, and that no one was to be hurt, molested, or restrained in his person, liberty, or estate for worshiping God in the manner most agreeable to the dictates of his own conscience, provided he did not disturb the public peace. The people of Massachusetts were to have the sole and exclusive right of governing themselves, and in an article intended to prevent the formation of a hereditary monarchy, an expanded version of a similar article in the Virginia Constitution, Adams wrote, "No man, nor corporation or association of men, have any other title to obtain advantages or particular and exclusive privileges distinct from those of the community than what arises from the consideration of services rendered to the public. The idea of a man born a magistrate, lawgiver, or judge is absurd and unnatural." In fundamental ways, the form of government was very like what Adams had proposed in his Thoughts on Government. And again, as in Thoughts on Government, he called for a government of laws and not of men. Founded on the principle of the separation and balance of powers, the Constitution declared in a single sentence that in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, the legislative, executive, and judicial power shall be placed in separate departments, to the end that it might be a government of laws and not of men. There would be two branches of the legislature, a Senate and a House of Representatives. An executive, the governor, who was to be elected at large annually and have veto power over the acts of the legislature. But it was the establishment of an independent judiciary, with judges of the Supreme Court appointed, not elected, and for life, as long as they behave themselves well, that Adams made one of his greatest contributions not only to Massachusetts but to the country, as time would tell. In addition, notably, there was Section 2 of Chapter 6, a paragraph headed, "The Encouragement of Literature, etc., which was like no other declaration to be found in any constitution ever written until then or since. It was entirely Adams's creation, his original contribution to the Constitution of Massachusetts, and he rightly took great pride in it. Wisdom and knowledge, as well as virtue, diffused generally among the body of the people, being necessary for the preservation of their rights and liberties, and as these depend on spreading the opportunities and advantages of education in various parts of the country and among the different orders of the people, it shall be the duty of legislators and magistrates in all future periods of this commonwealth to cherish the interests of literature and the sciences and all seminaries of them, especially the university at Cambridge, public schools and grammar schools in the towns, to encourage private societies and public institutions, rewards and immunities for the promotion of agriculture, arts, sciences, commerce, trades, manufactures, and a natural history of the country, to countenance and inculcate the principles of humanity and general benevolence, public and private charity, industry and frugality, honesty and punctuality in their dealings, sincerity, good humor, and all social affections and generous sentiments among the people." It was, in all, a declaration of Adams's faith in education as the bulwark of the good society, the old abiding faith of his Puritan forebears. The survival of the rights and liberties of the people depended on the spread of wisdom, knowledge, and virtue among all the people, the common people, of whom he, as a farmer's son, was one. "I must judge for myself, but how can I judge? How can any man judge, unless his mind has been opened and enlarged by reading?" Adams had written in his diary at age 25, while still living under his father's roof. As had no constitution before, Adams was declaring it the duty of government not only to provide education, but to cherish the interests of literature and science, indeed the full range of the arts, commerce, trades, manufactures, and natural history. In the last week of August, Adams had attended a dinner at Harvard in honor of the new French minister, the Chevalier de la Luzerne. The setting was the philosophy room of Harvard Hall, the old laboratory of Adams's favorite professor, Winthrop. There, among the philosophical apparatus, Adams had offered to some of his dinner companions his dream of establishing a Society of Arts and Sciences at Boston, as a counterpart to the American Philosophical Society at Philadelphia. The idea was to be enthusiastically taken up. The American Academy of Arts and Sciences would be founded in less than a year. But the dinner and the conversation were also an inspiration for what he wrote in the paragraph on education, and particularly the inclusion of natural history. Because wisdom and education were not sufficient of themselves, he had added the further duty of government to countenance and inculcate the principles of humanity, charity, industry, frugality, honesty, sincerity, virtue in some, and amiability as well. Good humor, as he called it, counted for the common good, the Constitution of Massachusetts was to proclaim, suggesting that such delight in life as Adams had found in the amiable outlook of the French had had a decided influence. He had written Section 2 of Chapter 6 in a burst of inspiration, the words flowing from his pen, but expected the convention to show it no mercy, as he later said. I was somewhat apprehensive that criticism and objections would be made to the section, and particularly that the natural history and good humor would be stricken out. To his surprise and delight, the whole of the paragraph passed intact, and, as he also noted, unanimously, without amendment. In the end, the convention approved nearly all of his draft, with only a few notable changes. Preferring what Jefferson had written in the Declaration of Independence, the convention revised the first article of the Declaration of Rights, that all men were